Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined as ever by Lahav Herkov. And Lahav, we just watched President Joe Biden land in Ben-Gurion, descend from
the
Air
Eagle
Force One.
The Eagle has landed.
Ladies and gentlemen, shalom and welcome to the welcoming ceremony for the President of the United States, the Honorable Joseph R. Biden Jr.
And beyond the historic significance of a president visiting here, and he is the seventh president to visit the state of Israel since Richard Nixon was the first one in 1974, it's his 10th visit to Israel, so he's been here a lot. But we'll talk a moment about the diplomatic and political significance of what this trip means for Biden, for the U.S.-Israel relationship, and for our current Prime Minister, Yair Lapid.
Mr. President.
But there were a couple of funny moments at the Ben-Gurion airport reception for him. What did you pick up on? Because I found a few as well.
So at the end of the whole ceremony, Biden and Lapid were walking away, and they didn't have microphones in front of them, but they were being followed by cameras, and you could sort of pick up on their conversation. And I heard Lapid saying something about his hair and something about Biden being tall. I was like, what are they talking about? And they were laughing. So
they were talking about like Khamenei's hair and his tall. Like,
sure.
You know, yeah, right. They were talking about some Iranian terrorist, no?
Right. So I texted Lapid's office and I was like, what was that? So Lapid said to Biden, I don't know if you remember, but I met you 8 years ago when you were vice president. And you said to me, if I had hair like yours, I would be president. And then Lapid said to Biden, if I was as tall as you are, I would be prime minister. Now, 8 years later, Lapid is still not tall and Biden is still bald. And yet they made it.
They made it. So a bald guy can become prime minister, president, and someone who's on the shorter side of the leaders of the world can become prime minister
Very
of Israel.
Very delicate way of putting it. But
shorter
it's been
side.
True for a long
I didn't say
time,
he's short.
Right?
I said he's on the shorter side.
I haven't looked it up, but I would imagine that Shamir was probably the shortest prime minister. And Begin
Ben-Gurion
was
also pretty
either.
Short, no?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah. He was standing on his head, so maybe we could, you know.
Right.
There was another moment where I was watching him from our offices in Jerusalem, but I saw two things. One was Benny Gantz, the defense minister. So they had like all the Israeli cabinet ministers came and they sat in these rows. And then there was a group photo where Biden later came and after all the speeches and he sat there and they took a group photo, which was very nice. But at some point while the ministers were waiting, the camera catches Benny Gantz, Israel's defense minister, who happens to be tall, if we're already talking about height, trying to open a water bottle with his teeth. Like over a number of seconds. I'm like, what's going on here? And then there was another moment, which was nice to see, of Benjamin Netanyahu, Bibi, comes, the head of opposition, former prime minister, and he's sitting probably the closest he's ever gotten to any of these government ministers in the last year. And he's sitting in between, I think it was, he was next to Mirav Mikhaeli, the labor leader. Behind him was Yoaz Hendel, from formerly of New Hope, communications minister. And Bibi was sweating. And Mirav Mikhaeli tries to find him a tissue, doesn't find him one. And Yoaz Hendel has a tissue, reaches into his pocket, gives it to him. It's a little crumbled up. He promises Netanyahu that it hasn't been used. And Netanyahu turns around and actually thanks him. So look at that, how Biden kind of brings the political divides or the sides together, bridges those gaps within
Maybe
Israel.
Maybe the second incident explains the first incident. Maybe Biden had to use his teeth because his hands were sweaty.
Benny Gantz, you mean, had to use his teeth.
Yeah. Why? What did I say?
You said maybe Biden.
Oh, no. I meant Gantz. Gantz had to use his teeth because his hands were sweaty. Listen, they had to stand outside for a long time, and it is hot, and there is no shade. And I have many hours of standing on the tarmac at Ben-Gurion Airport. It is unforgiving. So.
I spoke to one of the ministers afterwards, and he said to me it was terrible, just terrible.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, you know, to all those people who are talking about how Biden is old and tired and sleepy and can't move and can't walk. I mean, he seemed to do quite well. You know, he landed, he goes outside, it's hot, he's wearing a suit, he's got those cool Ray-Ban aviator shades on, he gives his speech, he mingles, he pumps fists and shakes some hands, walks up and down the red carpet, goes to the defense, they put on a defense show of all the laser and arrow missile defense systems and Iron Dome. He did okay, right? I mean, so, you know.
Yeah, he seemed perfectly fine.
So anyone who's worried about his age, so far, so good here in Israel.
May Israel and the United States continue to grow and prosper together for the benefit of the entire world.
There's some talk that his schedule for the second day of the trip includes a nap time. Although I will say, so Khan, the public broadcaster in Israel, reported that. And then I asked the reporter, I was like, does someone really told you that the president's going to take a nap? And he said, I asked why there's this long break in the schedule, and they said it was for rest. I don't know if that means a nap, but they reported it as a nap.
I mean, first of all, let the guy nap if he needs a nap, right? I mean, you know, I wouldn't mind a nap every day. But let's also not forget that he is the president of the United States. And while he is in Israel and there's a lot to talk about, I think just on the day we're recording this, on Wednesday, inflation hit a record high in over 40 years in the United States. I mean, there are other issues that the man does need to deal with, even though he might be in Israel at the same time. So rest could also possibly be time for him to deal with some of those other things that the president needs to manage, even if he's out of the country.
For sure. Yeah. It is unusual, I'll say, also, just that there's no dinner. Like, you would think that there would be a dinner between Lapid and Biden, and I checked with reporters who had been on this beat for a long time, and they said that there's usually a dinner. So I found that to be unusual. But tomorrow there's going to be a press conference. Well, by the time people will listen to this, there will have been a press conference and a ceremony at the president's residence where Herzog's going to present Biden with a medal. Mm-hmm. And Biden's going to say hi to the athletes at the Maccabiah Games, which is nice. I mean, we've been talking for weeks now about how they want something different, you know, something beyond the normal things. So this is his unique photo op that he's going to the Maccabiah Games, which is, you know, Jewish communities all over the world competing in athletics. And it's been going on for like 90 years now or something like that.
Yeah, long time. So that's nice. And that's going to be at the Teddy Stadium in South Jerusalem. Lahav, but you know, beyond the pop and all the kind of celebratory illustrations or demonstrations that we're seeing, and a lot of love and a lot of hugging and patting on the back, which is great to see and important, but there is some significance here, right? And you know, we've heard a lot about how this trip is really the sideshow, because on Friday, after he visits Bethlehem and talks to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, he then heads to the airport again and flies off to Saudi Arabia, which is the real purpose of this little trip to the Middle East, to try to get the Saudis, and particularly Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, to up the production of oil, to help the Americans lower the price of gas. But he's here, and there's talk of a Jerusalem declaration, right? Something that has to do with the expression of the strategic relations between the two countries, Israel and the U.S.
Right. It's supposed to touch on all different elements, whether it's, you know, the defense aid, other technological cooperation. So, yeah, I mean, I think it'll be an interesting to see the final text of the declaration, but it's supposed to reflect the commitment that the countries have to a strong continuing relationship.
And Iran is, from what you've heard from the Israeli side, right, in those conversations, the Americans are planning to bring up the two-state solution. They're planning to talk about the Palestinians, and Israel made some gestures ahead of Biden's arrival, where it's freezing planned announcements about new housing being constructed in East Jerusalem, and some gestures and to the Palestinians, goodwill measures. But at the same time, the Americans have said, and Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, said on the plane on the way to Israel that they want a consulate in Jerusalem for the Palestinians. They don't think they're necessarily going to get it, but they are going to be pushing for it. So you have the Palestinian issue, but Israel wants to focus more on Iran, right?
Yeah. I mean, the number one priority for Israel is Iran. everyone I talk to has been saying it, and you can see it in Herzog and Lapid's speeches at Ben-Gurion, that they both, the speeches were mostly just about, like, the U.S.-Israel relationship is strong and may it continue to grow, but the one, like, real issue that they mentioned is Iran and the Iranian threat.
Right.
Whereas her, Biden's speech was a lot longer than either of theirs, maybe even both of theirs combined. And it had a lot of that, but he mentioned a bunch of specific issues, including the two-state solution.
Which he said something along the lines of is the only way to ensure freedom and liberty.
There's something this like thing that they always say, equal right. measures of freedom, dignity, and a few other
for
things
both for the Israelis and the Palestinians. Palestinians.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But he did not mention Iran, which says something about a difference in priorities between the two sides. I found that very interesting.
Well, you know, what was also interesting was that on the eve of his trip, he published an op-ed in the Washington Post, right? And it was very defensive. It was kind of apologetic. In it, he mostly spoke about why he's going to Saudi Arabia, and that's because he's come under a lot of, he's been getting a lot of flack from within his own party on the more progressive side for the fact that he is now embracing the Saudis and MBS after what happened with Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist who MBS had murdered a couple of years ago. And Biden had said that he's a pariah and he won't be meeting with him, but now he's doing a 180 on that. So he had to go and kind of explain that away. It could be that this is part of that. Like, why am I in Israel? Why am I embracing the Israeli government? Well, I'm also trying to get them back onto the track with the Palestinians. Although he did say, Lahav, at the airport, that we don't see anything happening in the near future, right? You know, this is the two-state solution. I would like that, but it's not, you know, he didn't say in every all these words I'm saying, but he said nothing's going to move probably in the near future.
Yeah, I think that was the expression. He just said, like, not in the near future.
Right, which, by the way, is a realistic perspective, right? We've had, when he was vice president and Barack Obama was president, they never talked about not something happening in the near future. They wanted it to happen yesterday, right? So that itself was interesting to hear.
Well, just back to the, you were talking about the op-ed. What's interesting about that op-ed is that he really talks about Iran in it, and he talks mm-hmm. about the importance of countries in the region working together for defense against Iran, and that the U.S. is going to continue diplomatic and economic pressure on Iran for it to abandon its nuclear program. So you would think that it is a priority in the trip, but then he didn't mention it in Israel.
Well, I'm sure it'll come up in the conversations that he's going to be having, with the prime minister and his staff. So it will be interesting. I mean, there's a lot to talk about on the security front, right? Israel would want to see a tougher stance on Iran. They want to see, they want to talk about defense aid. They showed him the new Iron Beam, which is the laser version of Iron Dome. Israel would like to get some financing possibly for that. They need new helicopters and refueling tankers. I mean, I can only imagine the list of issues that they want to speak about. We ran a story on Wednesday that Avigdor Lieberman, the finance minister, had put together a paper within his office by his chief economist that talked about how Israel would like to create a regional network of trains and highways connecting Israel and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and parts of the Gulf, and it could help trade and move supplies and containers and shipping stuff from the east to the west and vice versa, and could facilitate tens of billions of dollars. I mean, there's a lot, and he brought that to Lapid and said, Lapid, talk about this with Biden as well. So, you know, Lapid and Biden will have a lot to schmooze about besides height and a hair, right? There are definitely some other things on the agenda. But what I wanted to say, though, is that Lapid gets points from this. In your opinion, right? I mean, you know, we are in an election yeah. season. This is a boost.
I do think this is a boost for Lapid. I don't think it's like make or break, but I also think that anytime that somebody else looks like a statesman, it sort of hurts Netanyahu's standing, because for so long he was quote unquote King Bibi. It was like he was the only one right. who had any international standing. So I think it helps Lapid sort of in that way. To show,
and,
like,
the, and no. By the way, in that group photo, which we mentioned before, Bibi didn't look happy. No.
No, he looked very unhappy. You never
know. He was like, he was in the second row, right? So in front of him was Bennett, and then next to Bennett was Lapid, and then Biden, and then you had Herzog. I mean, like, you know, and Bibi's not used to being in the second row. Bibi's used to being in the first row, in the front row.
It reminded me a little of that Bernie Sanders photo from the inauguration, you know?
Yes, except that Ben-Gurion, they were now, he wasn't wearing a winter coat with gloves. And but he did look upset. And I guess we understand why. Although they are meeting, right? There's a meeting on the books for Bibi and Biden.
15 minutes
at the president's residence, right on the sidelines of that reception that Herzog is hosting for him on Thursday. So they'll get their 15 minutes. I'm sure, you know, there'll be photo op. Bibi will tweet something out.
I was in on two press briefings, the Israeli one and an American one. And the question was asked in both, why is Bibi only getting 15 minutes? So in the Israeli one, the senior officials just didn't answer the question. And in the American one, it was on the record, so I could say it was National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on Air Force One. They had like a live feed, so I could actually hear the briefing live. And his answer was that they've had a long relationship and they're very straightforward and candid with each other, and they're sure the meeting will be productive and constructive. Does not answer what kind of meeting you're going to have in 15 minutes, but...
I mean, but again, on the other hand, what do they really need to talk about, right? If Bibi is elected in November and is able to form a coalition, then he'll be working closely with Biden on the big issues. Right now, I mean, Bibi needs to coordinate Iran policy with Biden? No. Does Bibi need to talk to Biden about defense aid? No. That's the Israeli government that does that thing. So, I mean, it's nice. It's important.
I'm sure Bibi will say what he can about Iran, though.
I'm sure he will.
That's his life's work.
But the substance of it is not, that's not where the decisions are going to be made. But it's important that Biden's meeting him because he's got to play both sides. Israel's heading to an election, and it wouldn't look good if the president only met with one side of the Israeli political establishment as we enter and as we begin this campaign. We have, in a break from the Biden and diplomatic arena, we have an interview this week with someone who you were very excited about, different reasons than from what I was excited for. So Julie Platt was recently confirmed as the chair of the Jewish Federations of North America. It was the JFNA. It's the umbrella organization that kind of oversees all of the federations and Jewish communities across North America, particularly in the United States. They're very active in support for Israel, Ukrainian Jewish refugees, of course, fostering Jewish life around the world. But one issue that came up, which with a great sense of urgency, is what's been happening at the Kotel. We've written a lot about this, but the fact that Jews have been attacked at the pluralistic / progressive prayer platform known as Azrat Israel to the south of the main, iconic men and women section at the Western Wall, at the Kotel, about a week and a half ago. The JFNA, together with the Jewish Agency, put out a very harsh statement and basically calling on the government to take action. And we at the Jerusalem Post have editorialized on this a number of times in recent weeks, and we went as far as to call on Yair Lapid in one of his first steps as prime minister to repass the old Kotel deal that was originally passed in 2016 by the Bibi government and then was reversed and canceled by the same Bibi government a year and a half later.
So I think it's interesting also. It's one of these times you wish that we could just put up the podcast like the day we interviewed her, or retroactively, I wish that, because she talked about needing security, right, for that section that specifically protects the people who want to pray in, you know, hold egalitarian prayers. And then in the ensuing days, the JFNA and the Jewish Agency Board of Directors, they unanimously voted to call on the Israeli government to do that. And I believe it was the Jewish Agency, but maybe it was the JFNA, who said if the government doesn't do it, then they're going to pay their own security guards to patrol the place.
Right, which won't be cheap, but is necessary, especially after what happened to this family from the United States. Conservative family was holding a bar mitzvah for their son, and they were accosted by a group of ultra-Orthodox youth. Even there was a terrible image of one of them who ripped out a page from the prayer, the Siddur, and blew his nose in it. You know, these really are the types of things that should not be happening. But your excitement, and we do talk to Julie Platt about this, was for a whole other reason.
Yes. Well, Julie Platt is the mother of Ben Platt, who has won an Emmy, a Grammy, and a Tony.
And is one away from, what did you call it? The EGOT?
The EGOT. Yes. Oh, you've never heard of an EGOT.
Listen, I'm not as culturally attuned as you are.
Well, I mean, it's very prestigious to be an EGOT. There's not a lot of people who have done
it. So he's missing the Oscar. Who knows?
He's missing the Oscar, yes. Mm-hmm. So he's he played the title role in Dear Evan Hansen, which was like a Broadway phenomenon several years ago, but has been a lot of things. Really brilliant actor, and also just like a really proud Jew. I mean, after the interview, I found you all kinds of videos of him on YouTube, and there's so many things of him saying prayers, singing in Hebrew.
With his brothers. And you ask Julie in the interview, how do you raise a kid like that? And she goes to explain and talks about what it was like to raise Ben and her other children. So it makes for a great interview, a lot of hot topics. Here we go, Julie Platt.
This week on the podcast, we have a very special guest coming to us from the States, from LA, right?
Correct.
Julie Platt, the chair of Jewish Federations of North America. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're here for several days in Israel and having lots of meetings. What is the top issue on the agenda for you right now here in Israel?
So previous to last week, I might have framed it differently, but I just had the opportunity to address the executive committee of the Jewish Agency about the disturbance at the Kotel last week, representing the diaspora as we do in particularly North America. We brought that to the forefront with some ideas that are going to be discussed further and in much more detail at the Jewish Agency about what we might do to avoid that happening again. Because one of the most important things that I hope to do as chair of JFNA is to increase, to work so hard to grow the relationship between the diaspora and Israel. And unfortunately, a kerfuffle like what happened last week doesn't help that hope to bring us all closer.
When you look at the recent years, and I think to an extent, there was a positive trajectory over time, particularly about the Kotel and the establishment of the egalitarian pluralistic prayer plaza back when the Sharansky compromise and deal was put forward and then accepted, but then reversed by one of the previous governments. Do you feel that we're in a good place in terms of the larger kind of 30,000 foot perspective, altitude perspective of Israeli diaspora relations, or have things gone backwards?
Oh, I think we're in a great place in terms of the Israel diaspora relations. I think this is my desire, and certainly the delegation that has come here from North America, is to make sure it continues in that direction. And something like what took place last week doesn't serve us well. It doesn't show the relationship at its best. And I think we're in a wonderful place. I think, you know, sadly, out of crisis, we've seen how we're all working together in the same direction to solve so many things that affect the broader Jewish community, from the crisis in Ukraine to the fight against anti-Semitism, that all of us are trying to work together towards, to the security issues that we face in North America right now that have been very much supported and addressed from our friends and partners in the Jewish Agency. All of those things are working well together. And the beauty of what we're trying to do in establishing flourishing Jewish communities and a robust pluralistic society in North America and in Israel, all good. It's the reason I think we're all so passionate about worrying about what happened at the Kotel, because we don't want that to derail. And something like that, unfortunately, is loud and therefore puts those good feelings at risk.
You know, I think the Kotel is an especially interesting issue because I think that it really shows the sort of differences and the concerns of American Jews, or at least affiliated American Jews, and Israeli Jews, right? Because it's an issue that no matter how much the various American Jewish organizations really try to sort of drum up interest, and it gets media coverage for sure, it just hasn't stuck as a political issue in Israel that that a lot of people care about. I mean, even the political parties that are supportive of the non-Orthodox position, it's not a priority for them. So I guess, what are you hearing in your meetings, and what are you trying to do to change that? Because it's been, this issue has been around for, I mean, technically for decades, but I think in the last decade or so, it's been more in focus.
You are right. Yeah. And actually, the comments that I made today in the executive committee meeting were immediately reflected back by one of my Israeli counterparts, saying, this is so much more on your radar than it is on the average Israeli citizen. This is something that they could hear the passion in my voice. And in fact, our new chair of the Jewish Agency, Doron Almog, shared my passion and spoke to it today. But I think it's getting attention in a different way right now of what are the actual specific actions that we might take instead of just talking about it. So I suggested a few today, and it will be the subject of a meeting just as soon as I get back to the Jewish Agency this afternoon, including things that begin with security. It's actually a very easy fix. If the government provides security around Eretz Yisrael, which is the agreed upon space, and this is a family that applied for it, did nothing provocative, just went to pray. If there was actually really strong security, really good way for it to go away. We also talked about what would it look like for an emissary from Jaffe to actually be at the prayer space welcoming families from the diaspora who come to have their prayer service there, to give good feelings as opposed to the opposite. But I know that you are right, that this is a voice that is louder from the diaspora, and I think from pluralistic society here within Israel, from the Reform and Conservative movement in Israel, than it is amongst the masses of Israelis. But we have to do it anyway if one of our main goals, and certainly mine as chair of JFNA, is to always bring us closer.
So maybe just to remind our listeners that what we are referring to was this event that happened a week ago of a conservative Jewish family from the United States was holding a bar mitzvah at the Azrat Yisrael, the egalitarian pluralistic prayer space at the Kotel, at the Western Wall. People came. There was some violence, scuffles. There's a terrible image of an ultra-Orthodox youth blowing his nose in a piece of paper torn from a conservative Siddur prayer book. So really terrible. And I mean, I want to zoom out for a moment, though, and kind of talk about your new role as the chairperson of the, is that right? Chairperson?
Chairwoman? Everybody's sort of playing with what it's
chairman?
Called.
No?
It mostly gets shortened to chair.
Chair. So you are the chair exactly. of the JFNA, the Jewish Federations of North America, which is the kind of umbrella group of all federations that are across the United States, and as everyone knows.
And North America.
And North America. Yeah. So that includes Canada. Thank you. As everyone knows, you have federations all over the place, right? These are, how many, 100 and...
There's 300 communities, 300. Which includes our network communities, 146 federations, and then lots of network communities.
Right. CEO being president is Eric Fingerhut.
Correct.
Right? What are the challenges? I mean, like, you know, America, North America, but let's, you know, particularly the United States, which is the larger of the two, it's going through some very serious challenges right now, whether it's anti-Semitism, security of communities and safety. There was a story the other day of something in San Antonio, right, with the Jewish community. You know, we saw what happened in Colleyville not that long ago. So you have safety and security and anti-Semitism. You have the political challenges and just general polarization across America. You're heading into midterms now in November, Roe v. Wade, and I think the Federation, right, put out the JFNA. Put out a statement on that issue, as did many other Jewish organizations. You have the Israel diaspora portfolio. I mean, it seems like a lot.
So you brought up some things that matter greatly to me. I will begin by saying we're an apolitical organization. So the things that we do, we are doing for every Jew, wherever they live, wherever their political leanings find them. Thankfully, and I will just a footnote to your San Antonio comment, we very much rely on the security information that comes out of SCAN, the Secure Community Network, that ultimately let us all take a deep breath when there was not actually a credible physical threat in San Antonio. The community, and you know, there's a saying, I think it's Ruth Weiss who said it, that when it rains on a Jew in Poland, a Jew in America puts up their umbrella. And that's the way we feel about the entire world. But yesterday in San Antonio, we were all breathing with stress over what we had heard, and thankfully it did not materialize, thank God. That being said, one of the things that I just completed, as National Campaign Chair of Jewish Federations of North America, I just completed my service in that role, was something called Live Secure. And I think that will answer a couple of the things that you've asked. We don't have the luxury of not securing the North American Jewish community, and I mean actual security. So we went about, and I had the honor of leading this effort, raising what originally was a goal of $54 million, and we actually raised $62 million, in a matching national fund that will be matched by every community in North America through an RFP process and a vetting process to provide them what they need for physical security. How sad we needed it, how grateful I am that we were able to raise it. It'll have to be matched 2-to-1 by the local community. But the focus, I don't want to be in this conversation about why we have to secure the community, because we all know it. Anti-Semitism is pretty rampant in North America. It's more that in order for us to focus on flourishing Jewish life and engaging Jewish life, if you're afraid to walk into the space where it's happening, it'll never happen. So the reason we took on this, it's called Live Secure, this Live Secure initiative, was so we could make everybody feel safe and secure so they would engage in flourishing Jewish life. So we've completed phase one. We raised that money lickety-split because everybody gets it. Now we're out in the phase of giving the money to the local communities through this application process so that we can do all the beautiful things that we want to do to make life flourish in North America. And sadly, the focus has been on anti-Semitism and fear.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about the physical safety element, which is so important, but also there's this sort of social element of feeling safe, of identifying as a Jew in a public space. I mean, we see that in college campuses, the atmosphere has gotten more and more hostile, and really just like whether it's political action or other, you know, more violence or vandalism targeting Hillel houses, just because they're affiliated with Israel or just because someone's an anti-Semite. But also beyond that, I mean, what is Federation doing, or what do you think that American Jewish institutions can do to make people be proud to be Jewish and not be afraid to be openly Jewish?
There's a lot of answers. I don't think any of us has one answer. But one of the things that we are hearing and feeling from our communities is this great desire to come up with answers. So IAN, which is a network that is part of Jewish Federations of North America.
Israel Action Network, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Is formulating a plan that very much speaks to the social media space. You know, there are simple things. There are the need to have influencers, and you all know about this, that can speak proudly and loudly about being Jewish. So we're very actively engaging those voices as best that we can, but there's much more to be done. The college campus space it's overwhelming. There isn't a day that goes by that someone doesn't send me or Eric Fingerhut a terrible story about a professor who is giving up tenure because they just can't stay in that space any longer. That's the United States of America. It's mind-blowing to me. So I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that we won't rest until we figure it out or do the very best that we can. But we are also not alone in this. I mean, people like Chen Mazik and the Tel Aviv Institute, he is spending 24/7 trying to influence and be an influence by being an influencer himself and influence others to become influencers. It's not a single pronged approach. It's as many prongs as we can think of until we figure this out. It's on college campuses. It's with the students, but it's with the faculty. It's with our educational system in a way that is mind blowing. And terribly disturbing.
Israel plays a role in this too, right? I mean, this is a two-way relationship. So just like you want to see
security guards at the Western Wall, pluralistic prayer space, there's also things that Israel could do, which turn off, or which Israel does, which turns off young Jewish people and turns them away from a stronger connection, let's say, with the Jewish state or maybe with their Jewish identity. That must be a topic of conversation.
Of course it is. I'll give you a tangible example of something that's happening, not just in our space, but in the North American Jewish community, which is something called Route One. I think maybe you might have heard of it. It's funded primarily by the Marcus Foundation.
Route One, we know, is our highway that takes us to Tel Aviv
okay.
from Jerusalem. That's how I get to Tel Aviv.
This
I get
would be
on
something
Route One.
Different.
I don't know that Marcus Foundation pays for the
they
highway.
They do not.
No, okay.
But in this case, there is an understanding that by the time a teenager gets to the college campus, if they don't understand the nuance and the conversation around Israel that is so problematic for young Jews, with honesty and exposure to all sides of the issue, they're not equipped once they get to a college campus. And Birthright is a mechaya, but it's late. It's late. You're already there. The Marcus Foundation had this idea, now joined by many partners, and now are going to work with us as well to get thousands of teenagers here. And I was at a gathering last night of thousands of teenagers that are here from North America that are being exposed to Israel with all of its complexities before they hit the college campus. It seems so obvious, and many of us participated in programs. I'm a Romanic. I grew up through the Ramah system. My five children did too, came here on Ramah seminar and spent summers in Israel. But they're the exception. They're not the rule. Though thousands of teenagers come, it has to be multiple thousands of teenagers that come before they're faced with the kind of aggressive opposition on college campuses so that they have the language. We're criticized in our North American teen programs that we weren't clear enough or explained the complexities of the political life in Israel as much as we should have. We have to now. We are going to do that now while fostering the kind of love for Israel that can only happen by putting feet in the land. And that is the greatest desire of ours, is the more people of all ages, but I'm just talking about one example of teenagers of every age. So you will see, and frankly, and I'll have to find some metric that's going to prove me right someday. I don't think the pandemic helped. I mean, I think the fact that there were not feet on the ground for the last 2 years and the incredible rise in hate on the social media space, I don't think that's a coincidence. There weren't enough Jews here.
It's great to bring people here for a week or for a summer. But I mean, the thing that I think would give people especially strong tools for a strong Jewish identity and also for knowing about Israel is Jewish schools, which have become less and less affordable over the years. Is the Federation trying to promote, not Orthodox necessarily, but people going to more Jewish schools and trying to make them more accessible to more Jewish people?
So let me answer that in a couple of ways. I'm going to answer you from the Jewish camp view first.
Yeah.
I actually think Jewish camping is one of the secret sauces that responds to what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And we've done a tremendous amount in the Jewish camping space, which is a piece of affordability that we can bite off without waiting. I come to this job from having previously been the chair of the board of the Foundation for Jewish Camp for 4 years and am the product of Jewish camp. Day school education is astronomically expensive. It's on the agenda of every Jewish organization of how do we crack it? And who's going to be successful at the kind of endowment funds that are necessary? I don't know the answer. I'll simply tell you that, except to know that it is recognized as a huge problem, the expensiveness across the spectrum of getting kids into a Jewish day school education. But one of the things that has been successful and that we can afford to get behind, and we have made a difference, both from Foundation for Jewish Camp, but it's done in partnership with federations across the country, is to make Jewish camping, to incentivize Jewish camping, to provide scholarships for Jewish camping, because every study that you read, and you can read literally any study of Jewish life in America, you send a kid to Jewish summer camp, their relationship to the Jewish people will last a lifetime. And that's just not some throwaway phase. I grew up in Wichita, Kansas. There was no day school. And many of those 300 communities I just talked to you about, they don't have a day school. So we can't rely on day schools to be the answer. All of our Jewish communities don't have them. I didn't have one, but my parents sent me to Jewish summer camp. And I'm going to tell you everything that got me to sitting here with you and being the chair of Jewish Federations of North America. Happened at my parents' Shabbat table, for sure, and by their example, but 100% happened in my life in Jewish summer camp. And that is something we can affect and are trying to do.
So I do want to talk about the personal journey, because I think it's interesting when people go into these types of roles of Jewish political roles, which a lot of people, some people stay away from because of the complexities of the Jewish world. But I do want to push back on something else that we spoke about just before, and maybe push you into a corner.
Great.
on the Israeli diaspora relations and the Israeli government, right? The way I look at it, here from my vantage point at the Jerusalem Post, is that the Israeli government we've been reversing in terms of things that could help bridge the divide between Israel and the diaspora. Whether it was the decision in 2017 to reverse the Kotel decision, the violence that breaks out there every Rosh Chodesh, right, every new month when the Women of the Wall come. Of course, what happened the other week, but also in other areas of religion and state, right? There's been no movement on conversion. There's been kashrut. No movement on the kashrut reform is tiny, but not, you know, nice to have, but nothing truly significant. Civil marriage is still nothing that's happening. Reform and conservative rabbis still can't officiate over weddings or divorces in this country. The Jewish cycle events, many of them. I mean, these are big issues for the North American Jewish community. And unfortunately, when I look forward on the horizon and I see continued political instability here in this country, or paralysis as we head to another election, I'm not overly optimistic that anything's going to change. So what do you think?
So it's not backing me into a corner. All of those issues are on our agenda. I will say to you that we have always had a very good relationship with Prime Minister Lapid. He's spoken at the GA, which is our largest gathering. And we took last Thursday's incident for a great opportunity for every one of the large organizations, Keren Hayesod and WZO and JFNA. We jointly prepared a letter and hesitated for about a minute to send it to Lapid to say, don't for a minute think this isn't the most important thing right now happening for the diaspora. Part of our agenda is to be extremely loud about issues of pluralism. We are pluralistic Judaism in the United States of America, and it must be responded to by our Israeli partners. We don't have the power to make change, but we do have the power to use our voices. We feel very good as funders of so many things that happen in Israel, but there's no bribe here. There's no strings attached. We'll always take care of those things that help with Aliyah and absorption and those things that matter to us in our ethics and values as Jews, but we're not quiet, nor have ever been. The problem is the person that we're talking to, the government that we're talking to, tends to change pretty frequently. But that doesn't change.
That is a problem. But we feel that too.
But that doesn't change the passion with which we speak, and we do speak loudly. Mm-hmm.
So in the few minutes we have left, I want to ask you something that you probably get asked a lot. But how do you, as a mom, raise such a genius son? You're the mom of Ben Platt, who's one Oscar away from an EGOT, Emmy, Grammy, Tony, and he's only 28 years old. The probably best known for playing the title character in Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway. What's the secret?
Okay, so even before I start, I am the mother of 5 children. Ben is the 4th of my 5.
6 grandchildren.
6 grandchildren, 6 grandsons.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I will say that I am lucky enough to have 2 other sons who are engaged in the entertainment business as well. And in all of the cases, we were highly intentional. That's the answer I will give you. My husband is also in the entertainment business. He's a producer as well. And we made a decision very early on that we would try to keep encapsulated his entertainment life and bring our children up in a richly observant and engaged family. My children are the products of Jewish day school and of Jewish summer camp. They live by the example of my parents and my grandparents before us, and that my husband and I have tried to model for them. And they are simply continuing in an organic way to live out their Jewish values. And Ben is one of them. He is proudly Jewish. I don't think there's many people who have sung Guys and Dolls in Hebrew on a late night TV show when someone asked him about his Ramah experience in musicals. They are proudly Jewish, all five of them. My older son, Jonah, is very outspoken on Twitter about his pro-Israel feelings and is one of those influencers that I'm extremely proud of. And otherwise, they'd hear it from their mom and their father.
So you mentioned you grew up in Kansas. How did you find you? I mean, Kansas is far away, right? To an extent. How did you get on this journey that's taken you now to the top of JFNA?
My parents led by example. My mother and father in a very small Jewish community were all the roles. Israel Bonds Federation, president of the synagogue, president of the sisterhood, president of the men's club, president of everything. It was expected of my siblings. I'm one of four. My sister's the president of the New York Federation. My other sister and brother are deeply engaged in Jewish life. It wasn't a decision. It was an expectation that we would organically follow in the footsteps of our parents. But the simple truth to the trajectory is I was trying to figure out what college to go to. My Sunday school teacher, who was my Sunday school teacher my whole life in Wichita, because there was like two Sunday school teachers in Wichita, and she went to Penn. And she said to me, I know you, and you need to go to Penn. And I went sight unseen, and thank God, I think I fulfilled their geographic distribution of getting someone from Kansas. And I got into Penn, met my husband the first week. And we moved to New York. I got deeply engaged in Jewish life in New York, then moved to Los Angeles and followed again in my mother's example, became the chair of the women's campaign in Los Angeles, and then the general campaign, and then the chair of the Federation in Los Angeles, and then the national campaign chair of JFNA, and here I am. So.
Okay. Well, this is, and how long is this role for?
3 years.
3 years. So Julie Platt, the newly installed chair, relatively new, chairperson.
Weeks.
Of the Jewish Federations of North America. Thanks for being with the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We'll be back next week. If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please send it to your friends and family and give us a high rating on Apple Podcasts. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, all the major platforms.